Okay, the last bit of the story, and into the 20th century then, the short 20th century, of course centuries are all the same length as each other in theory, but in practice historians are always a little worried about saying, oh, let's study the 19th century and we will stop on December the 31st, 1899, because of course, what changes from December the 31st, 1899 and January the 1st, 1900? Nothing. No, it's not an important date from a historical point of view. And so very frequently, if you get a book, England in the 19th Century, you will often find that they finish in 1914. Often in 1914, except if it's a very old-fashioned book, and then they stop in 1901 because the Queen died. And it's very, very important when Queens die, isn't it? Well, I mean, it is important, but, you know, I mean, it doesn't absolutely transform people's lives like the First World War did. That's a little bit more important somehow. In particular, Eric Hobsbawm, my own favourite historian, he wrote a famous book, yeah, called A History of the Short 20th Century. Now, when is the short 20th century? From 1914 until? Yeah. If you were writing a history of the short 20th century. So you choose 1914 as a beginning because it's a very important date. For Eric Hobsbawm, he used to be in the Communist Party. 89, yeah. 1914, 1989. A history of the short 20th century. Yeah. And very often we have a history of the long 19th century. The long 19th century ends in 1914. When does it begin? It's an opinion, of course. When would you begin the long 19th century? It's more than 100 years. 1789, the French Revolution to the First World War. It's a logical break, yeah. But I'm getting carried away. That's not so important. Anyway, today I'm going to look at mostly two particular dates, 1919 and 1926. And they are both, then obviously they're both after the First World War. And the First World War has changed so many things. Not just because a lot of people died, which they did, of course, but even the people who didn't die found that their lives changed completely. First of all, from a sort of social point of view, the First World War involved a big mixing of people. Suddenly people who never spoke to each other, you know, the society before the First World War, very hierarchy, yeah? A lawyer or a doctor will never talk to a worker, and a worker will never talk to a very, very rigid. And in the war, of course, that's not possible. Yeah. If you've got everybody in the army, even though there is the hierarchy, of course, in reality, in the very extreme situations, there was a certain social mixing, firstly. Secondly, the government was suddenly involved in controlling almost every aspect of the economy. The 19th century idea that the government should do the minimum is completely destroyed by the First World War, where the government is obliged to do the maximum if they want to win the war. And so the government controls the economy. During the war, the government comes to control the economy, sometimes for purely economic reasons. Yeah, they need the ammunition, they need the guns, they need the ships. And so they have to order the companies, you must build ships. I know you want to build something else, it doesn't matter. You build what you're told, the government controls, you know, what some people call a state capitalist a system. And secondly, if you want to win a total war, you have to have the support, the active supports, if possible the enthusiastic supports, of the majority of the population. What did that mean? That meant, for example, little by little, the introduction of rationing. Rationing was extremely popular for a very simple reason. When the war breaks out and international trade is extremely difficult, what happens to the price of food? It goes up very, very quickly. The poor have real problems getting enough food. So if the government did nothing, well, the rich people would eat and the poor people would not eat. Now, of course, if you want hundreds of thousands of new people in the army, it's better if they eat first. Yeah? And also from the point of view of civilian morale, this is very important. So rationing, it's quite funny, because when we think of rationing, if we think of it from an individual point of view, we think, oh, it must be really annoying, rationing. In fact, in wartime, rationing is a measure of social justice. Relative social justice, yeah. But it meant everybody gets a bit of meat. Yeah, that was the business. So these big changes, government social intervention, the very first works canteens were invented in the First World War. Les tout premiers cantines à l'usine. This the city du net and con d'avance, hein? That was very important, yeah, that people got decent food at work, cheap, decent food at work, works canteens, yeah, factory canteens. Et le restaurant de l'entreprise est rentré dans les mœurs maintenant. And they were invented at this time. The government also intervened in other ways, that they were very worried about alcohol. For some good reasons. And in the First World War, they introduced for the first time limited hours. All the pubs must close at 11. And this remained the case until 1998 or something. It was the police. That one of the things which were invented in the First World War. It's okay. I've calmed down this week. I'm not dangerous anymore. Okay. The First World War invented the licensing hours. This rather bizarre habit, which perhaps you remember going to England and finding all the pubs closed at 11 o'clock. Yeah. It's not the case anymore. It's changed in the last 5 or 10 years, I don't know. But this was invented in the First World War. We don't want people to drink so much, so they must. You could open a pub, I think, from 11 o'clock till 2 o'clock, and then from 8 o'clock till, from 6 o'clock to 11 o'clock, and that was the law for. So, all these changes during the First World War. But let me get back to the actual subject. So, trade unions, and in particular, trade unions in 1919. During the war, there were not a lot of strikes, partly because they were illegal, partly because people really did believe, yeah, that it was important for Britain to win the war. And so when you wanted to, if somebody wanted to organize a strike, it was more difficult because people said, oh yes, but you know, this will interfere with the war efforts. It has to be said that in general, during the war, although the war was everybody hated the war, in general the big majority of English people thought that Britain was right and needed to win. Yeah. The anti-war movement was always, well, I can't remember actually if it was 6,000 or 6,000, there were a few thousand conscientious objectors, and there were probably, you saw demonstrations of 5,000 people against the war, but 5,000 people against the war, not 50,000 or 500,000, you know, a small, so there was a movement against the war, but it was never possible to make a mass movement, with the slight exception of Glasgow, where it was a bit bigger. So during the war, not many strikes, but some strikes nevertheless, in particular in Glasgow, in 1915, very big strikes in Glasgow. But yeah, Glasgow was this rather exceptional place, partly because there was a communist tradition there, but also because a lot of the Scottish workers saw the government in London as defending the interests of England, and not particularly of Scotland, which was probably not unreasonable. After 1915, however, the big strikes in Scotland began to interest people in other parts of the country, but didn't become massive. However, once it became clear that the war was nearly finished, and that the war was almost finished, and that Britain was going to win, then a lot of trade unions and others wanted better conditions and so on. Now, not everybody's conditions had got worse during the war. If you weren't killed, yeah. For example, in the munitions factory, the factories which produced the bullets, conditions were quite good. They needed workers, and so they paid quite good wages. Yeah. So and many people found that they lived better during the war, yeah, because the government was determined that production should be up, and so there are many measures that show that people's nutrition levels were higher during the war. Yeah. Bizarre. It's a sort of thing, really. So what kind of strike did we see in 1918? Well, you've got to remember the political side, because especially during a war, it is impossible to divide trade unionism and politics during a war, especially because when you say we want to strike for more money, everybody says, but what about the war? Yeah, so it becomes political immediately. And also in the other way, so what was happening in 1918? Well, the Russian Revolution had massively influenced people around the world. Now, this is a little difficult to, from a non-historian's point of view, it is a little difficult to see today, because when we think of the Russian Revolution today, well, when Mr. Landa thinks of the Russian Revolution today, the first thing they think of is the terrible labor camps and the massacres of the 1930s, and or the collapse of the Berlin Wall in 1989, when the people of the east of Europe made it very clear that whatever this system was, they didn't like it. Yeah. Let's go back, however, and look at it from the point of view of ordinary people in England in 1917. The Russian Revolution, the new revolutionary government, said, we're stopping the war. They stopped the war. Then they said, we are publishing all the secret treaties. And they published the secret treaties signed by France, signed by Britain, and the population of Britain and France could not believe it. Our government signed this secretly without telling us. It was an extremely shocking situation. Also, the Russian Revolutionary Government replaced a previous government, the Tsarists, the Tsar, which was medieval, with very, very large numbers of executions, of starvation, and so on. And so the Russian Revolution was extremely popular, especially among trade unionists. Like I say, it gets more complicated after 1925, after 1928, and it becomes horribly complicated in the 1930s. But we're not going to talk about it today. It was extremely popular, and it wasn't just Russia. In France, the big mutinies. There were mutinies in 1917. Soldiers refusing to fight, and some of them executed and recently rehabilitated by the French government. I think about 5 or 10 years ago, the French government signed to say that these people who were shot for mutiny were rehabilitated. Yeah, that they were being subjugated. I don't really want to joke about it, because I think their families were happy. It was important to some people. In Germany at the end of the war, very, very big mutinies. There was almost a revolution in Germany. There was an attempt at a revolution in Germany, led by Rosa Luxemburg, Karl Liebknecht, who were both killed. In Italy, 2 years, the Biennio Rosso, 2 years of massive strikes. This is where Antonio Gramsci learnt his ideas. So the idea that in Britain too, the elite were very frightened. It was a very real danger, probably more dangerous even than 1848. And just to help this, in 1918 there was a big strike. And who was on strike in 1918? The police. The British police. Now, if you are an elite, I don't know, try to imagine yourself as an elite, you don't like it when the police go on strike. It's a very bad sign, yeah? It's much worse than, from the point of view of the elite, it's much worse if the police go on strike than anything else, except the army. Because, you know, it's very, if the shops or the banks go on strike, that's pretty sad, but the police, I mean, you're supposed to be able to rely on them. So what happened? They demanded more money, they wanted better bonuses, better pensions for widows. Yes, a lot of police had died in the war, and they wanted money for the dead, not for the dead wives, for the wives of dead policemen. You know, the widows, yeah, you know the word widows. And they also wanted money for their children, children's allowances. In August 1918, they called a strike. And the government at this time was, they'd never seen a police strike. Well, the police won't go on strike, of course not. I think it wasn't actually the first time. Suddenly there were 12,000 police on strike in London. The government brings out the army. But of course, one of the problems is that the army and the soldiers tended to sympathize with the police. Terrible situation. And so the Prime Minister, Lloyd George, was very, very quickly. The one day later, agreed to end the strike. An increase of 13 shillings. So that's an increase of like 20%. 20% wage increase. This means he was frightened, yeah? 20% wage increase, better pensions, better bonuses, some money for the children, etc. Yes? Bonuses, yeah, bonuses. Yeah, des primes de guerre, des primes, bonuses. So, in fact, they won all of the of their demands, except official recognition of the union. Et le gouvernement ne voulait pas reconnaître officiellement le syndicat des policiers. But they got all the other things. Yeah. To recognize the trade union. Yeah, so they said, okay, there's a strike. This time we will give you what you want, but we do not want a permanent organization of policemen as a trade union. Fair enough, yeah. It has to be remembered, of course, naturally, this police strike was illegal. But the problem is, when you have 12,000 police on strike, what do? Put them in prison? And then the government had to worry, can we trust the soldiers to put the policemen in prison? Yeah, when the policemen are demanding money for the widows, it's a political question. Okay, so the head of the police had to resign, and the negotiations continued. Although the government tried to stop the police trade union, the National Union of what? Police and NUPPO. Je vais pas noter. NUPPO. There you go. National Union of Police and Police Officers. No, can't be kidding. I don't know. NUPPO. There you go. They right. Okay. And of course, the government then organised a committee to investigate the conditions of police. You know, that's governments often do. Very, very interesting, because it allows us to see how much they earned. Not a huge amount of money. In fact, a lot of the police were paid less than labourers. Yeah, than people who worked in building sites, just carrying things around. So it's interesting. Yeah, that it was not well paid. Although today that has changed. That has changed. The government passed a new law in 1919, the Police Act, and this established the Police Federation, which is a kind of a special trade union controlled by the employer, a company union, really. So the Police Federation. So the new law said the police may not belong to a trade union. It is illegal for a policeman to be a member of a trade union. However, we organise the Police Federation to defend in a more moderate way the conditions of police. The police trade union was not happy to be banned, and so they called another strike. However, this strike was not so successful. In London, only 1,200 went on strike. Out of 18,000, only 1,200 went on strike. But in Liverpool, however, this strike in 1919 was very successful. This is an interesting case, because there was quite a lot of rioting in Liverpool that people seemed to take advantage of the absence of the police, especially in a time when people were very poor and there was a lot of stealing and looting. The army was sent in, several people were killed. The strike was defeated. In fact, every police officer who was on strike in 1919 was sacked. All of them. They were all sacked. So quite radical thing on the other side. So there you have those two police strikes, very significant, 1918, 1919, and fundamentally the 1918 strike, very successful. of the 1919 strike, which was a minority strike, absolutely unsuccessful, to such an extent that all the strikers were sacked, which is quite unusual in a strike. Now, this, of course, was not at all, these were, of course, were not at all exceptions.